Chapter 2. The Warrior's Way. Early on a cold morning, a few days after Lila's visit, I was summoned to the path in front of the villa. Here, a cart was being loaded with produce for the farm. Jars of preserved fruit, sealed with honey, were stacked next to barrels of smoked meat. Dried vegetables in pots were also added, along with sacks of flour milled on the villa. Two large cheeses and a good number of jars of beer completed the collection. It was time to take the Fiorm to Lord Wallace in Market Wixton. The Fiorm was the due in payment Father made to his superior lord. In turn, Wallace would pass on to the king a portion of what came to him. The estates of the more senior nobles and that of the king relied on this obligation. In exchange, the king and his lords offered security and the protection of their swords against any enemies. Once the cart had been fully loaded, our party gathered for the journey. My father was going, as was Cuthwin, along with two men from the village. I would not be much use unloading the cart, but I think my father felt that it was time for my education in our traditions to begin. It was a morning's walk to Wixton, and we reached it when the sun was high overhead, warming us on this clear but frosty morning. Wixton had several score houses, two alehouses along with a blacksmith and other workshops. Looking back, it seems funny to me now that I felt it such a huge place after being to Ealhwarwick, Chester and London. Yet, it was now with wide eyes that I stumbled along behind the cart. We stopped outside the largest building in the town. This was the hall of Lord Wallace, who was the most important noble in the south of Deira, made even more influential with the proximity of the temples and the royal estates at Godnunningham, just an hour or two further away to the northeast. My father went inside and came out with an older man with grey streaks in his beard. He was a little shorter than my father, but somewhat larger in the belly. He walked over and patted me on the head, and then smiled. "So, this is Curdick then, Kenred. Another fine son and a credit to you and Hrodwin. Ah, I see you have a good fjorm for me again this year. Even with the drought and those blasted locusts earlier this summer, you have not failed me."
"We have good land and good men to work it, my lord," my father replied.
"Well, let's get it inside then," Wallace shouted over his shoulder to his servants, and then, quietly to my father, he added, "Use your delivery for Ainfled, I take it." My father glanced at me before replying in a rather gruff voice,
"As always, my lord."
Wallace nodded and then passed me to supervise the unloading of the cart, leaving me wondering what they were talking about. Who was Ainfled? It did not take long to unload the cart, but I noticed that they had left two sacks of provisions at the back of it. When I pointed this out to Cuthwin, he told me not to mind them, as they were part of the Fjorm. "What are they for, then?" I asked. "I said don't mind them," he snapped back at me. Father then took us to the blacksmith to order some nails, and then have some tools made that our smithy could not manage. The blacksmith was a bold man with hugely muscular arms, which strained and bulged as they hammered a rod of steel. He was making a sword, alternatively heating the metal in the forge, hammering it on the anvil and plunging it into water, throwing up a cloud of steam and smoke. As my father entered, the man nodded at him, then put the sword and hammer down on the anvil. The two of them, along with my older brother, went over to the corner to examine some nails. The sword was still glowing, and it drew me towards it as if by some sorcery or magic. Perhaps, I mused, the blacksmith was enchanting it. I had heard tales of such things, but then again, swords needed no spells to draw me to them. I glanced at the others, but they were still eagerly haggling over how many pounds of nails could be bought for a pfennig. I looked back at the sword, itching to hold it, and I reached out my fingers and lightly touched the blade. With a yelp, I snatched back my hand and sucked the fingertips. The sword had still been red hot. Father came bustling across the room, glared at my fingers, and then slapped me firmly, but with no real spite, over the back of the head.
"Fool, you've burnt your fingers. They'll blister and fester if we're not careful. I guess while we're here, we'll have to see the healer woman is at home and can treat that."
He shook his head and tutted and stomped back to finish his negotiations. While he continued to haggle, I noticed he kept glancing over at me, as if weighing something up. Finally, he nodded to himself, as if a decision had just been reached. We soon set off again, and I expected us to go straight home, but instead we deviated down a side road. A short way along it, the cart slowed, and I could see someone not far away. She stood beside the road in the late afternoon shadows, which formed under the eaves of a house. As we approached, my father, who was sitting on the front of the wagon, seemed to stiffen. I looked at my brother and was startled to see that he wore a scowl. She stepped out into the road, and my father, jumping down, went over to her. They spoke for a few moments, and then he handed the two sacks to her. Without any more words, he then walked back to the cart. When he had gone only a few paces, she called out to him. She was gesturing into the shadows where, I now saw that a boy, perhaps a little younger than I, and with brown hair like his mother's, was standing. The lad looked up at my father, eyes hopeful, desperate even. My father stared at him for a long time, then shook his head and turned away. The boy's eyes became wet, and he ran over to his mother. She held out an arm and embraced him. They turned back towards us, and I could now see that both of them were staring, but not at my father, nor at Catherine, but at me, and upon both of their faces was an expression of utter hatred. The cart started off again, and we moved away down the road towards home. As we passed the last house in Wixton, I twisted round and glanced back up the lane. The woman had gone, but I could see that the boy was still looking our way. Even at this distance, I could feel the strength of his feelings towards me. Confused, I turned and leant forward towards my father and opened my mouth to ask a question, but then I saw Cuthwin shake his head, and I held my peace as we returned home. It was only a few days after this that my father came to Edward, Cuthbert and I, while we were helping Carefid repair the roof of the great barn in preparation for the winter storms. That is to say, we were fooling around and he was doing the work. "Curdick," he shouted over to me from the villa, "come here and bring the boys." I exchanged a worried glance with my friends and saw that the same thought was passing through their minds. We hadn't done anything wrong today, had we? But my father was smiling when we reached him. "Today it is time to begin to leave childhood behind and set out on the journey to manhood. You are all old enough to learn the arts of war, for the day may come when you need to defend your family and lands, just as your fathers and grandfathers have done before you." As he spoke these words, I saw that he had put on his sword, his brother's sword. It was hanging from a strap worn over his left shoulder, so that it lay against his lower chest. He noticed I was looking at it and pulled it out of the baldric. It was a great blade of shining steel that my father polished every evening. It had a bronze guard and a patterned pommel. He swung it swiftly around in an arc, so that it cut the air with a faint whooshing sound. Sunlight reflected off the blade for a few moments. I imagined my father in the role of the heroic warrior in one of Lila's tales. His voice brought me back from my dreams. "This," he said with a proud voice, "belonged to Kinric, my brother, and your grandfather's eldest son. Before you were born, there was some fighting to the north. King Aelor was always trying to find a way to defend us from the stronger Welsh kingdoms and to make us stronger, and one day the chance came. The kings of Eorforwic were not afraid of us, but they saw the threat in Benicia, Firebrand's land up north, around the Tweed. They marched there, but were slain in the Battle of Caer Gru." He paused and looked at us, perhaps trying to see if we were following any of this. We had heard it all before, of course, but listened attentively. "Anyway," he went on, "Aelor now saw an opportunity to expand our holdings and to secure our grasp on these lands, and he summoned the warriors. Your uncle Sinric went away to war, and he fought in several battles. In the last one, he was leading a small force of local men from this area. He was sent away from the main army to prevent a relieving force of Eber Archai and Elmate reaching the city. It was a hard battle, and all the men including him were slain, save one. However, they had died for a cause, for the enemy army was defeated and ran away to Elmet. So, Eorforwic was finally captured. Aelor won the war, and our people have been safe ever since." I glanced at Cuthbert. I knew his grandfather was one of the men my uncle had been leading that day. The tale was often told on feast days. It was the campaign that finally secured Deira as a nation and had given us peace during my lifetime, just as the recent victory at Lindisfarne had apparently assured the safety of Benicia, our brethren to the north. Cuthbert looked proud. Edward, meanwhile, was staring at the sword with longing. "Now, the main weapon used in wars is the spear, but you will find that some men do own a sword too, particularly men of rank and wealth, for blades are more costly to make," my father was saying as he put the sword away. From the villa came the sound of a wooden spoon being clattered against an iron cooking pot, and from the kitchen door drifted the smell of herbs and cooked meat. The midday meal was ready. The workers were making their way to the great barn, where they sat down to broth, bread, and a goblet of ale. My father glanced that way and gestured with a finger. "Right then, off you go for food now, but tonight, after the evening meal, come to the east paddock, and we will begin," he ordered. The afternoon seemed to last forever, but finally, after a meal that held little interest, Edward, Cuthbert and I rushed to the east paddock. We were the first there, but shortly afterwards my father arrived, and with him came Grettir. He was one of the older men from the village, and owned some land to the north granted him by my grandfather. My father turned to us and spoke. "Grettir here was with my brother in the wars. He brought his body back for burial. He is the most experienced fighting man in the village. I have asked him to teach you about weapons and fighting in the time he can spare." We looked at Grettir. He was a broad-shouldered man in his late 40s, with black hair and a beard, both of which had wisps of grey and silver. He had not said much to me before when we had met around the village, but he usually nodded and gave a grunt of acknowledgement. He was carrying a pair of wicker shields and some wooden mock swords. My father went over to the gate and climbed up to sit on it, so he could watch us. Grettir walked over and tossed Cuthbert and me a sword and a shield each. The shields had a strap behind the centre, and we grasped these. "Now, boys, step apart about 5 paces and face each other," Grettir ordered. We moved to comply. He went on, "Now, attack each other." Cuthbert and I exchanged glances and shrugged at this. I braced the shield against my chest and extended my right arm so my sword was pointing at my friend. Cuthbert tried a different approach and ran straight at me. That took him by surprise, but the threat of his attack was blunted when he tripped over the sword and ended up rolling head over heels straight into me, knocking me flying so that we both went down in a heap. From the gate I could hear Edward collapse into a fit of laughter. Giggling from beyond the wall hinted that some of the village girls were watching this. My sister Mildred bobbed her head over the wall and back again. Then I saw Edith, Cuthbert's cousin, give a quick peek at me. My father turned a stony face towards them, and they disappeared again with more giggling.
"Get up!" boomed the voice of Grettir, like a wave hitting the rocks. "You," he said, pointing at Cuthbert. "If this had been for real, you would be dead now. You must learn self-control. You are not in one of the sagas now."
Cuthbert's face was now glowing bright red, and his hands were shaking.
"As for you, Master Curdick, your posture was all wrong. You should not have been knocked over by him. You should have been in a position to take advantage of the folly of your foe, and not end up in a tangle of legs and arms."
Grettir picked up my shield from the ground, where it had fallen, and then took my sword. He held the shield away from his body, in front of him, so that it was turned towards Cuthbert, who was staggering to his feet a few yards away. He then twisted his whole frame, so it was facing to Cuthbert's left. He held his right leg straight, but bent his left leg a little, so he was leaning forward. Finally, he thrust his sword into the air, slightly above and to the right of the shield.
"This," he said, "is a warrior's posture. Observe how I advance."
He moved his left leg, still bent at the knee, forward a pace, then brought his right leg forward, still straight. He advanced again, left leg bent, right leg straight. While he moved forward, he still held the shield braced away from his body, and had his sword at the ready position above the shield.
"In this way, a whole army can stay together, advancing as one, with shields ready to protect you, and your fellows and swords ready to strike at the foe."
Grettir told us, and as he continued to move towards Cuthbert, he now reached my friend, who had now got himself into something resembling the warrior's posture. He looked terrified at the arrival of Grettir in front of him, and half closed his eyes. I heard a derisive snort from behind the fence and saw that Aidan was standing there, watching us and looking scathingly at Cuthbert. My father saw this as well, and his face hardened. He then lifted one finger and pointed back towards the house.
"You slave! Get away! This is no place for your sort!" he shouted.
Aidan flinched at that, as if he had been struck, and slunk away, humiliated. He waited until my father turned his back on him, and then shot him a glare full of spite and hatred. Grettir continued his instruction.
You can now strike your foe in three places. You cannot hit the body, as it is protected by the shield. You can strike down onto your foe's head thus.
At this he moved the wooden blade down to just above Cuthbert's head. My friend gave a whimper, which caused Edward to giggle again, this time earning him a clip over the head from my father.
Or, continued our teacher, you can angle the blow to his right arm, his sword arm. The third target would be his left lower leg, which is visible beneath his shield.
Swiftly, Grettir knocked Cuthbert's sword out of his grip, then slapped his shin. Cuthbert yelped again and hopped around, rubbing his leg while sucking his fingers. Grettir grunted at these antics.
You will endure greater pain than that in battle if you do not learn to pay attention. Now, pick up your sword, said Grettir.
Cuthbert, obviously fearing another blow, moved quickly to comply. Our instructor turned back to me and threw me the other sword and shield.
Begin again, he ordered, and this time try and use your shield to block the other's attack.
I adopted the posture that Grettir had done and found that you could advance on your opponent in steps whilst holding the shield ready for defence and the sword for attack. As we closed, Cuthbert tried to bring his sword down on my head. I shifted the shield up and deflected the blow. I then returned the same blow, and as I expected, Cuthbert lifted his shield in imitation of the defence I had used. So I adjusted the angle of attack and brought my sword down onto his left shin and was rewarded by feeling it hit home.
Good work, boy, said Grettir.
My father and Edward applauded, whilst Cuthbert groaned again and looked even more miserable. So, I began to learn the trade of the warrior. Over the next 7 years, when Grettir was free to teach us, we received instructions in the art of warfare. We learnt about the use of the bow, sling, and the small throwing axe, the Francisca. These weapons were used by skirmishers to break up enemy shield walls. We also were taught about how the long knife, called the sax, was the basis for the other name the Welsh sometimes gave to our race, the Saxons.
But you will not see the sax used much in battle, except in dire need. It is more useful in hunting, Grettir commented.
Grettir proved to be an enthusiastic teacher and took to his task with zeal. There were times when he got together boys of families from the nearby villages. Cuthwin, who was also being taught by Grettir with three older boys, my friends and I would form a shield wall and defend against teams of youth invited along.
Individually, you are weak and vulnerable, and no one protects your rear or flank, but together you are strong. Your fellow warriors defend you, and you, them, Grettir would say.
As the years passed, we boys grew up. Edward and I became tall youths, although Edward was broader in the shoulders than I. Cuthbert lagged behind us, and was 3 inches shorter than us and much thinner. Edward would always win games of strength, such as wrestling and lifting weights at festival times. However, Cuthbert began to show greater agility. He became accomplished at juggling, a skill I was never able to master. As for myself, whilst I was not as strong as Edward, or as agile as Cuthbert, they both deferred to me in decisions about what games to play or where to go exploring. As the years went by, and the boys we had been became youths, I realised I enjoyed leading them. Of course, it was not just the boys who grew. Mildred, my sister, began to change from the rather clumsy, slightly plump girl to a slim but tall adolescent. We were past 14 now, and my friends began to leave their eyes lingering on her, but strenuously denied this when I asked them about it. Edward always had a joke to explain staring at her as he had done my uncle's sword.
I was just thinking, from the side, when she holds her arms out, she looks like a scarecrow, he said, with a snigger one afternoon, when I had caught him watching Mildred walk past.
Cuthbert, however, would just blush and turn away, or rapidly change the subject. I sneered with derision at them both.
You boys made me sick. I'm going to be a warrior one day. Do you think I'm going to have time to pay much attention to girls? I said, feeling I had scored a point.
Then I turned my head and saw Edith running after Mildred. She wore a loose-fitting green gown hanging from the shoulders, and as she ran, there was a mixture of bouncing and swaying within the dress that was quite distracting. I stared at her open-mouthed and felt a tightness come to my throat. She saw me looking, smiled at me, and then waved before running off.
Nope, I see that now, Curdick. Girls have no effect on you at all, said Cuthbert dryly, and Edward roared with laughter.
Aidan was also maturing. Being a slave, he was not permitted to join in the training for war, but I often see him lingering in the shadows beside the barn or sitting up a tree watching us, unless my father caught him. If that happened, he would be sent away with a clip to his head. Aidan's eyes were darkening to a deep red, his hair to jet black. I hardly ever heard him speak, and whatever his thoughts he was having, he kept to himself and just studied us in silence. We boys called him Loki because, like that god, Aidan seemed to have been able to disguise and conceal himself, appearing suddenly from the shadows. Loki was also the god of trickery and deceit, and we began to think of Aidan that way. We started talking about this quietly when he could not hear us, but over the years he had stumbled onto us as we joked about him, and must have heard what we said, because we could see him getting angrier with the passing months. Aidan was a slave, and so had no rights or recompense for any hurt he had suffered. He could do nothing, and did nothing, but save bite his lip and stomp away from us, until one day, Edward, Cuthbert and I, had been practicing with swords again, and were coming back to the villa, hoping to steal some bread, when Aidan came rushing out of the kitchen door and collided with Edward.
"Clumsy Welsh bastard, you should watch out for your betters," Edward snarled at him,
and then shoved Aidan from the top of him and tossed him down into the mud outside the door. Aidan's tightly bound fury exploded like a snake leaping up to bite at its prey. He surged up from the ground, punched Edward, and then kicked him at the shin, all the time swearing and cursing in Welsh. Edward was stunned for a moment, and then swung his fist round to connect heavily with the boy's chin. Aidan was heaved through the air, hit the door with a splintering crash that knocked it off its hinges, then slid down to the ground. The noise must have been heard all over the estate. My father and Grettir came running from the barn, and Carefid emerged from behind the ruined door and bent to examine his son, a crumpled heap on the ground.
"What in Woden's name happened here?" Grettir demanded of Edward.
My friend was standing glaring down at Aidan, breathing fast, his fists clenching and unclenching.
"This little runt hit me, that's what happened,"
Edward shouted, pointing at the Welsh boy. My father turned to question me.
"Well, son," he said, "is this true? Did Aidan attack Edward?"
Everyone now looked at me, and their faces each wore a different expression. Cuthbert, shocked at the sudden violence, knowing that this was not the full story, but unsure whether to speak. Edward, demanding I back him up. "This is about loyalty, Curdick," his expression was saying. Carefid's face was tense, afraid for his son, and hoping I would say something to help him. Grettir, impassive, watching how I dealt with the situation. Finally, I saw Aidan's face. He looked at me like a warrior looked at an enemy who has captured him in battle. There was defiance, there was hate, but there was no hope for mercy. Maybe this, then, was the moment for mercy. This was the moment to show Aidan that his blind hate was wrong. I could speak the truth. It was an accident, and flared tempers. Nothing more. I could have said that we had teased the slave and called him names, and that was why he was angry, but I didn't. I kept silent, and just nodded my head, and I let Aidan be punished. Father's face darkened as he turned to Aidan.
"On your feet," he hissed.
Aidan did not try to defend himself. He stood sullenly, not speaking or saying a word, but with dark eyes fixed on me. A slave hitting a freeman could expect death, but, after his temper had died down, it was Edward who stepped in and actually defended the boy, saying perhaps he had spoken harshly, so, instead of being hung, he was thrashed by Grettir. Grettir used a birch branch, and with every swing you could see Aidan wince in agony. But he never cried out or yelled, not once. He just kept on looking at me, as if it was all my fault. He was right, of course, which only made matters worse. Chapter 3. Lila Returns. This had happened in the autumn of my 16th year, and soon afterwards it was time to pay the fiorm again. I was strong enough to go with my father alone, leaving Cuthwin on the villa. Wixton was familiar territory by now, and once the work was done, and knowing that Father and Wallace would spend some considerable time talking about gossip and news, I wandered around the town, stopping at the blacksmith, and, as I always did, examined his swords and axes. Grothir, the blacksmith, nodded as I entered, and let me examine a blade. Whenever I visited, it was always one sword above all that attracted me, the same one, in fact, which I had once burnt my fingers upon. He had used the finest metals and ores, and taken the greatest care in its creation, forging a weapon of dark-coloured steel, with highlights of bright gold and bronze on its guard and grip that made it a thing of beauty. As such, it was expensive, and even though the years had passed since its making, He had not yet sold it, and I hoped he never would. Not until I was ready for it. Narrower, but longer than my uncle's sword, its balance was excellent and perfect. Grothir let me take a few practice swings, all the time wishing, as I always did, that I could afford to buy it, and longing for the day that I might use it in battle. I was just putting the sword back on its rack when I felt the hairs prickle on the back of my neck, and I sensed that I was being watched. Turning round, I saw, lurking in an alleyway across the road, the dark-haired lad who had watched me from the shadows each time we visited Ainfled. He had grown since last year, but not quite as much as me. His hair was a more dark chestnut brown. His shoulders were not as broad and his arms not as muscular as mine. Yet, there was something of the wolf about him, as he stood lightly on his feet, seemingly ready to pounce. I took a step towards him, wanting to ask who he was and what he wanted, when my father stuck his head out of Wallace's hall and called me over. As I ran across the street, I glanced back at the alleyway, but the boy had already gone. My father and Wallace had been drinking, and Wallace offered me some ale as I came in. The hall was dimly lit, and from what little light penetrated from the door or the smoke hole in the high roof, but the gloom made more cheerful by a welcoming fire burning in the central hearth. The air outside was damp, and I happily took the offered drink, then sat close to the fire to dry off.
"Well, that's the last of those Welsh rabble we're here about, mark my words," Wallace was saying, as he topped up my father's goblet from the jug of ale and then poured me one. I slipped some of the strong brew and sat staring absently into the flames. I was sullen and quiet, still bothered by what had happened to Aidan a few days before, and also wondering what problem this brown-haired lad seemed to have with me.
"This is good beer, Wallace," my father said. "What's that you were saying, Lord?"
"It's just what I hear," Wallace replied. "A war merchant from the mountains passed this way last week. He told me that he heard it from a Welshman who spoke to an Aaron himself."
"An Aaron," said my father in an awed tone. Even I had heard of the poet and bard Aneurin. He was Welsh and still young, but Lila said he was a genius. I had to ask what that meant, and Lila had said it meant someone unlike me.
Aneurin travelled the Welsh kingdoms west of the Pennines, Strathclyde, Gwynedd and Uriens Rhegid. I had heard he even came east once, to Elmet, our neighbour and the only Welsh land our side of the mountains.
"So, what I hear is," Wallace slurred his words and then burped, "what I hear is that Firebrand has led his army out of Benicia and gone into Rhegid, killed loads of Welshmen. Urien's son, what's his name?"
"Owain," I said. Stories of battle bringing me back to the conversation. Owain had succeeded his father and was now king in Rhegid. Wallace beamed at me like I had won a prize.
"That's the chap. Anyway, what's his name is trying to get the Welsh together again into an army after most of them got killed a few years back up north. What I heard is he ain't doing very well, and Firebrand is looking to finish him off," Wallace concluded, before sliding down off his chair and starting to snore.
My father winked at me and slurped some more beer.